Among the many repercussions of the COVID pandemic, it caused actors, including myself, to question our purpose, our abilities, and our own belief in what it means to be an artist. Well, today's guest had many of these same doubts and questions well before there was any pandemic affecting our industry. He felt an internal struggle between what he wanted to do and what he thought he should be doing.
Hey, everybody. My name is Brian Pateka. I am originally from a tiny town outside of Cleveland, Ohio. So I'm a Midwestern boy, and now I live in sunny Pasadena, California, and I am a life and career coach. My niche is really helping actors find representation, and I believe that acting is your vocation and it is your birthright, and that's really where I sit at the crossroads of commerce and spirituality.
Though Brian is now a life coach as well as a non-denominational minister, he started out as an actor here in New York City, grinding it out, going to auditions, looking for representation. But he shares with us three stories of how he let go of expectations and allowed himself to find his purpose, to find his true calling. And in that process, he had to let go of plans and the very clear path that he had laid out for himself. But in doing so, he found a joy and fulfillment beyond anything he had anticipated.
Booking it was a big deal, and getting the audition was a big deal. All the pieces of it felt really big to me. And then doing the job and going like, oh, that's what it is. I guess that's as big as it gets to feel. And I was like, nope, there's more for me to do.
Welcome, and thank you for joining me for another episode of Why I'll Never Make It, an award-winning Top 25 theater podcast. I'm your host, Patrick Oliver Jones, an actor and singer, talking with fellow creatives as they bring us three stories from their own life of personal struggles and professional hardships with lessons we can all learn from. The website is whyillnevermakeit.com, where you can subscribe to bonus episodes and offer support to the production of this podcast. Again, that's whyillnevermakeit.com. I wanted to give a little backstory into how this interview came to be. It was actually back in February of this year, 2022, that one of the assistants to Brian reached out to me, suggesting him as a guest on the podcast. I feel very blessed and fortunate that I'm now in a position where people are actually reaching out to me, so I was grateful for the email, and Brian seemed like a perfect guest to talk about his experiences. So we set up an interview in March, but that day came and went. I had been sick leading up to it, and it just went out of my brain, and I completely didn't show up to our initial Zoom interview. He was concerned and wondering what happened, and I, of course, was very apologetic. So then we set up something in June. That fell through because I had callbacks that were going on. So then we went back to May and finally set something up. So this interview has gone through its ups and downs, some my fault, some not my fault, and just having to do with both of our schedules and putting it together. But I am so glad that Brian stuck with it. I'm so glad that he understood, and I am so grateful to have him on the podcast today. Welcome, Brian. This has been a long time coming, months in the works, but we're finally here.
I feel like I really better perform today because we've been trying to schedule this for a while, but I'll try to do my best to really take center stage if I can.
Well, I mean, it says something about both of us that we're... Well, of course, that first time, again, in going with my title, Why I'll Never Make It, I missed our first one. So, yes, I appreciate your patience, but then, sure. You know, one thing after another, we've both been busy people.
Yeah, and I'm glad you're better. And I'm glad you're better. And I think that busy people, you know, it's hard to connect. And that's, you know, why we're even having this conversation is because of all the things that we do in our lives, right? So,
exactly, yeah. Exactly. And I want to just dive right into the first story that you wanted to talk about. And this was when you believed that you had to be an actor. You know, even when you were starting to get annoyed with auditions and this and that, because you had spent so much time, energy, money investing in that pursuit. Now, had you tried other ventures so that a career in acting just felt like your only option?
So at the same time I'd been acting, I feel like this is part of my Midwestern growing up, is like, you can't just be an actor. Like, you have to stay, you have to be busy and working all the time, mm-hmm. or maybe it's toxic productivity. However, I was always having a second job. I remember when I was in New York City, I was doing the Donkey Show, and I was in the Donkey Show for like 2.5 years. And Diane Paulus was directing, and it was a fabulous time of my life. It was like my first job in New York City, off Broadway, whatever. But at the same time, I had a day job while I was doing 6 shows a week. No one else had a job in the cast. I was like, well, of course I'm going to have a job. Like, what are you doing during the day? And then go to auditions. So there was a part of me that already had this, like, it is normal to do something as well as acting, that had normalized for me. So I know a lot of actors get challenged by, like, if I'm doing something else, it means I don't really love acting, or I'm not putting my whole heart in it. So somehow that had normalized for me, of like, you having two passions at the same time. And so what happened was, I was on set. I can almost remember. Oh, you might hear Peacock right now, everybody. Lucky you.
Right, the Peacocks are here.
Yeah, they're here. I think I was on set for a TV show in LA. I'd lived in LA for probably a year and a half. I think it was a show called The Ringer with Sarah Michelle Gellar, if I remember correctly. And I was so annoyed to be there. And not because anyone was a jerk on set, or like there was like a badly run set or anything, but I had canceled on a couple of clients that I was coaching, that I worked with as actors to help them with their career. And I was like, whoa, what am I doing here? I had this huge, like, what the heck am I doing here? I want to be with my clients who I love to help in this. Like, I got this like shock in my system, like, oh my gosh, what if that's what all this has led to? What if all this acting is me being able to be better at helping actors? And I was like, no. This is just a thing. It's going to be the side job. It continues to be the side job. You're meant to be an actor. So the voices came rushing. And, you know, I went to Northwestern, and, you know, I'd gone to school and I'd been training, and like all this had led up to this. What about your resume you'd already created? And so I remember
because you were still finding enjoyment in the acting, right?
Yeah, I was. So here's the difference. I was finding enjoyment doing the acting, but I was like, in the same way that you might think of like a hobby, right? You're like, you love to be in your acting class, or you love to like work on it. But I wasn't actually finding the joy in getting the job, because the job was a time when I was no longer the captain of my own domain, right? I had to be at a certain place at a certain time because someone said to be there. And then it took me away from the time that I would have been spending with a client, right? And so I remember this friend of mine said, well, what if you don't quit all the way, since that clearly you can't do that, you're not ready to do that. What if you just like, don't put energy into it for like 2 weeks? And I was like, what are you talking about? I'm an actor. There's no way. So she goes, so she let it go. And then like the next week it came up again. She said, so I'm going to just revisit the idea of maybe you could, you know, and she was a coach, so she knew how to say this. I said, okay, fine. What do you mean? And so I finally was like, okay, fine. Here's what I'll do. I will not do the work that I do to make my acting career happen. Like, I won't submit myself. I won't go out and look for workshops. I won't send postcards or do emails or any of that stuff. I'm going to take a step back there. Of course, I'll still be a good client to my manager, and we'll see what happens over the next few weeks. And it was the most freeing. I felt so free. And I don't say that to inspire people to quit acting, but I think you have to always know that when you're, whatever you're doing, like, you're saying yes to it day after day. You have to, you know that you're saying yes to it. You're making a decision each day. And that freedom that gave was like, oh my gosh. And suddenly like my coaching practice got really busy, and I had a bunch of clients I was working with, and I was so happy. And I didn't drop out right away. Like, I still did commercials, because commercials were always fun. And it was like one day on set and you were done and you made a bunch of money, and like, it was easy. So that to me was like, yes. I didn't have to do the grind of like, let's make sure casting directors know me. And that felt like so much lighter. And for a while I was doing commercials as well as coaching. And then I was like, slowly my agent was like, do you still want us to be submitting you? Because I'd like turning down auditions. Cause like, oh no, I have 3 clients today. There's no way I'm going to go to an audition in Santa Monica. Thank you very much. I would much rather be with them. And so I'll say, you know, I always find that like annoyance is sometimes the mother of invention. So I'm not saying necessity, but I feel like for me, it's like the feeling of annoyance. I was like, so my feeling of having to not be where I knew I was serving or helping was so icky. I wanted to be where I was helping people.
Well, it's interesting that you brought that up, because your story of going to auditions was like, it's work. I'm submitting myself. I'm doing this. And then you finally get the job and you kind of have to stop that for a day, a week, however long that contract lasts. And then you're back to it again. And then you're in the motion, and then you stop. You do your work. And it's interesting, the way that you brought that up just immediately brings to mind COVID and how we all had to stop. Yes. And now our busyness was gone. And I think that I know for me, that brought up so many questions of,
what do I do now? How am I going to get through this? And so I assume that for you, you know, obviously without a pandemic, but for you, that stoppage of the busyness, the productivity that I'm actually doing something is kind of what gave you the light bulb of, I actually enjoy the, as you said, the work, the busyness, but not actually the doing of it when I'm hired in some way.
Yeah. And to even make a finer, maybe even finer distinction on it, it was the actual experience of having to email a client and say, I cannot meet with you tomorrow because I'm going to be on set, which is supposed to be, I'm so freaking excited. I'm going to be on set tomorrow. And there was a little part of me, of course, that was excited. I booked the job. I got that hit of the agent or the manager calling and say, you booked the job. And I got that little bit of juice. And of course, I'm like, I'm so sorry I have to schedule tomorrow. Da, da. And then by the time I got to set going, whoa, I am not. And this is real spiritual. And for me, this is a very spiritual experience of, I am not adding to the goodness of the world by being on the set today, where when I am coaching, I know that I am. And that was like, oh, wow. Like, also there's like, who do you think you are kind of thoughts come up, of course, or like, who do you think you are that you're that helpful, or like that your ego's talking, like all those things. And for me, I always think like, just so everyone's also clear, I'm a non-denominational reverend. So I want to make that very clear. So all religions, no dogma, but who do you think you are? You're God's gift. And I say, or you're the universe's gift, whatever word works for you. But yeah, that's right. You are. And so I had to like believe into that for a while to say, oh, I'm as great as I'm no more special than the person next to me, and everyone is special, but that I can believe into, it's okay to find that you feel that you are helping more over here. Because I think so many actors, you know, I always find that actors are, you know, they're either an activist or they're this close to being an activist because they care about the goodness of the world. And I think that, you know, that's why I find so much art can be political and can make statements. And I think that's an awesome part about why art changes the world. And so to me, that I was like, I'm not feeling my impact in where I know that I'm meant to do. And I feel it so much more when I see a person who's like, oh my gosh, yeah, I can try it that way, or I can do it this way, or, oh, that's a good way for me to reach out to people, and that they are moving forward. And then I know that they're making their impact as an actor. So yeah, it came through disappointment of having to not see people. I mean, honestly, I feel like it's very like ready. It came through my selfish extrovertism of like wanting to be with a person that I was talking to, because I feel like that's where I'm energized.
Well, and this gets to the part of, a lot of times we find out what our passion is by realizing what we don't like to do. Like whether something is annoying, as you found acting to be, this audition process, or by having to be without something. It's like you go along and all of a sudden something's taken away. You're like, wait. But I want more of that. And once it's gone, then you start to realize that's what I'm missing. And if I have more of that in my life. And I was reading up on you, and I was noticing that before you lived in Los Angeles, you were here in New York for about 11 years or so. And you freelanced with 12 different agents during that time. Mm-hmm. Now, was that you just feeling busy? Like, I'm going from this agent to that agent. Or were you unsure? Like what kept you bouncing around?
I was very lucky. I worked a lot. And so I knew how to get an agent to notice me and start sending me out. That was something that I figured out really, really quickly. And in New York, I don't know why none of these dipshits would sign me, to be honest. I was like, okay, so I'm just going to freelance with everyone in the world. And that's what it was. So I was going on 4 and 5 auditions a day. And I was like, you know, carrying a book bag with the clothes and da, da, da. And it wasn't because of desire to be, because desire for the work. I was like, get the agent. Great. Give me an audition. Let me move on. But there would be times when I have to take a piece of paper and write, okay, you're going to take this subway to this place in Chelsea. Then you're going to go here. And you know, this agent's covering you for this and this agent. And then what happened is, and the reason why I finally got signed is because I was having to say, oh, I just want to let you know I'm on first avail for this. I'm on second avail for this. I'm on hold for this. So I had to communicate with each of these reps every time I'd get booked. And I will just say again, I was really lucky. If 10 days passed and I wasn't on set, I was like, what's happening? Why am I not booking work? Like, that's how busy I was. I was really lucky in this period right here. And so that, if you can imagine though, so if that means that's how many bookings were coming through. So think about how many on holds or callbacks were happening where I was having to tell everybody, I'm on first refusal for this. I'm on first, you can't. And so finally one of these agents said, Brian, do you want to come in and just sign? Because I feel like this is a lot. And I was like, thank you. What needed to happen? So I had bought into the idea of, I need to show a track record before an agent will say yes to me. And it worked.
Now it sounds like, that sounds like a wonderful problem to have. To be so busy.
Yeah, right? I loved it.
It sounds like the dream, but at the same time, was it exhausting?
Oh, no, I freaking loved it. I loved it because I'd be going to what. So here's two reasons why. One, of course, I was making money because I was booking things. And you, and I think you probably would agree with this, is you get a hit when you go in that room and you know you did good work, whether you book it or not. And if there is a place where that muscle gets grown better than anywhere else, I believe that is in commercials, because you know it's not about you. You know it's like they need somebody older, they need somebody younger. Like, you're able to write off it not being about you so easily in the commercial world. When it comes to larger roles in theater and TV film, you can make it's easier to kind of let in that it's about you a little bit. But that was building that muscle for me. So I was so free in any theatrical auditions I was getting because of that. So I love that hit that I would get. I love seeing the same guys there. There also was a little bit of a thrill of like, this is probably some weird internalized homophobia, where like there would be all straight guys in me and I would book the job. And I feel like I pulled one over on them because I was passing or something, which is probably some real sick internalized homophobia. But it also was a good way of getting back at this people in seventh grade who made fun of me. So too bad for you. I would just say that. Right. But it was a total thrill. Now, I will say the moment that I was like, oh no, I need to move to LA, was one of those days when I had four auditions carrying a book bag and there was snow on the ground. And I was like, why am I doing all this work so hard here? That was one of the days where I was like, oh, I think I want to entertain LA. But other than that, I freaking loved it. I mean, of course, I was like stopping at my gym to go change into a suit for the next audition and grabbing a subway stand. Like, that was how busy I was. And
well, see, I remember just having to, and this is back when I lived in Jersey, so I had a long walk to the station, and then I'm in Midtown, so I'm just walking everywhere. But yeah, I remember having to just carry a towel to dampen the sweat off of my furrowed brow from just being so hot. So I had a towel and then an extra t-shirt just in case I started to sweat through it. I mean, so yeah.
All that annoyed me. Of course. I mean, I remember walking by the book bag and having hangers hanging off the back of the book bag. Yes. You're nodding your head. You totally know. It was like a dress shirt and a suit jacket and my dress shoes. Totally. Oh, and of course I wanted to go to the gym at the end of the day. So like I had all, like, you would pack the bag for the day, especially if you were coming from Jersey. I can only imagine, like, I have to have every pair of shoes that I need, every shirt. Yeah.
I wasn't going back home.
No.
Yeah. I have it all with me.
Also, I think I bring that, but just so a lot of people who moved to LA who come from New York kind of still bring that energy of, well, you leave the house once, right? Like, you don't go back home again. And so when you first get to LA, you have this incredible experience of, wait, I can put things in my car? I don't have to carry it. Like, it becomes this whole new experience of like, I don't have to carry everything, which is why I think a lot of actors who come to LA sometimes like, oh no, I like the quality of life here. I'm not schlepping as much sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, there's the weather. There's also, yeah, you're in your car, which, yeah, you're in your car for an hour, hour and a half sometimes. Right. But yeah, you do at least have that option of having your mobile home, so to speak, your mobile closet there in your car. So what was that moment for you when you first began to question if acting was then your right path?
It was truly, I think I'll go back to being on set. You know, I remember I booked for me what was a big job at the time, which was I booked a role on the season finale of Newsroom, I think season two. And Aaron Sorkin was there and Alan Poole. And like, it was a really exciting, and there was walking and talking and like totally fun. And I was like, oh my gosh, that was, and like booking it was a big deal and getting the audition was a big deal. All the pieces of it felt really big to me. And then doing the job and going like, oh, okay. That's what it is. I guess that's as big as it gets to feel. And I was like, there's more for me to do. There's more for me to do. So it was both a combination of canceling on clients to have to be on set, and then the experience of doing the job and going, oh no, there's gotta be more like cycle. I mean, there's something selfish about it in some way. I think it also so selfish and not selfish in that you're listening to what the universe is calling you toward, because it's saying, oh, you're not feeling that cycle of when you put energy in, you are also affecting people. And that just wasn't doing it for me. I mean, let's pretend I'd stayed in New York and continued to do theater. Maybe I would have felt it there and it may have gone a different way, but that's not.
Because there's a different aspect of live versus on camera. Sure.
Totally. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
So then in leaving acting behind, did you feel like you had failed or that you were giving
up? Oh, hell no. Hell no. I felt like not at all. I felt like, oh my gosh, what a gift that I felt gifted by new understanding. I felt like, oh wow, all the work that I have done has led me to be a better coach and to work with this, like I'll be tell you very honestly, I know coaches who like work with people who are architects or work with people who are nurses or work with whatever. I'm like, I feel like I'm a selfish coach, because if you work with actors, actors express themselves. They have expressions. They're not afraid to show their emotions. Like, it is fun to coach actors to work in this way, because they're not afraid to tell you how they really feel. And sure, there can be drama because of them. You know, we can get into our drama, but I think that's also part of what I loved about it. And because I loved being backstage with my actors at the Donkey Show or all the shows that I'd done over the years. Right. And I knew how to be in that energy. And so all that just taught me how to empathize with someone who is continually being asked to put themselves out there when they are their own product, or put themselves out there and say, I believe, because I think two things happen. One, yes, you are your own product, blah, blah, blah. Someone said that in 1998 and we still say it. Number two is every time you put yourself out there, you're also acknowledging or being seen as, I believe I'm meant to do this. And I think a lot of other businesses, like, no one asks that question. You're an accountant. We don't question, like, sure, you're an accountant or you're a lawyer. But in acting, we have a belief of that person believes they're meant to do this, that we bring to the table for them. And that's the same with like painters or whatever. But in acting, it's so present and vital in that moment. So I'm even thinking about the audition room or the self-tape or in theater, right? And so I love being someone who can help someone feel more, remembering why they're here in the first place. And I just became so clear to me that my experience of doing that gave me the power to empathize with that experience. And I was like, awesome. I have the gifts that I need to be an excellent coach. And I'll say, you know, right now, the only thing I ever miss, and that's something we already talked about, the only thing I ever miss about an acting career is that hit that you get when you did a great job in the room. That little hit of like, oh, I freaking slayed that. If they don't book me, it does not matter, because that was awesome. And that is not actually anything to do with being a good actor. That is like competitive CrossFit stuff. That is like, right. That's, and like, and I'll say there are actors, I mean, you've probably heard this, where someone says, well, I didn't have to audition. So it does. And like, it means less to them when they're offered a job than when they have to audition, because that hit of competitiveness means something to us. And I think we have to take that away, because it's the other side of that, I think, is compare and despair. But that is the only thing that I miss, I can say. It's not like I want to go out on a stage and or anything like that, which I don't think I'd ever at the moment knew that I'd be able to say, right? I think that came more as I was living into this. That came experientially, I should say.
Brian is right that auditions can oftentimes feel like a competition. We're just so busy worrying about how we compare to everyone else. Well, in this week's bonus episode, Brian talks about a dance call where he allowed himself to just be himself, without filtering it through the lens of what he ought to be doing or saying. And as someone who doesn't usually enjoy dance calls, I know that fear and worry and expectation that weighs me down when I have to perform in a way that isn't, you know, just isn't very easy for me. But Brian shows how being authentic can make all the difference in the world. Now, bonus episodes like these are only available to monthly supporters of Why I'll Never Make It. So, if you'd like to help this podcast, as well as get bonus episodes like these audition stories, then please consider being a monthly subscriber by going to whyillnevermakeit.com and click subscribe, or just look for the link in the show notes.
Well, to take a step back, we'll get into your second story. And this is one that I can actually relate to, because I also grew up with a single mother. And you say that she struggled to get by. And because of that, that you focused yourself on this idea of making money, being secure, that this is what it meant to be successful, you know, to have that behind you. And so I'm guessing that you and or your mother, your brother that you grew up with, that you didn't feel this security or success while you were growing up.
Yeah. You know, my mom, I'm watching my accent come out now that I'm saying the word mom and we're talking about Midwest, y'all.
Mom,
right? I don't want to paint the picture that we were, you know, my mother was struggling to get by. And there were the two of us. My dad lived in Philadelphia and we lived in Ohio. And I think that what I took on was the big brother, man of the house kind of energy. Like, I need to help establish our house and create a foundation, which I don't know if it was healthy or not healthy, right? I feel like I'm an okay, healthy person. But at the time, I think it made me into be a good student, I became a paperboy at 12 years old. I had a job all the way through high school. And I think it was my way of saying, and I think because I was modeling, watching my mother do this, is I need to learn how to provide for myself because no one else is going to do it. Because my mother wasn't just, you know, my dad wasn't just shoveling money into her bank account so that she could just take care of us. She was having to work to take care. She worked the entire time I was a child, right? And so I think the lesson that I learned was you're going to have to take care of yourself. And so stepping out and saying that I wanted to be an actor was scary. I remember my mom saying, who was totally supportive and believed I could do anything I wanted to do. She goes, "I'm just afraid. I think only famous people's kids become actors." I remember her saying that to me. And I was like, well, when Gwyneth Paltrow was the model for who's booking and getting the Academy Award at that time, it's not hard to say there's a lot of Nepo babies out there. I totally get mm-hmm. it. But she believed in me and I was a good student and all that. But I do think I took that lesson on as you're going to need to cover your ass. You're going to need to take care of yourself. There's some degree of you having to cover your ass and take care of yourself when you get into the real world. And I think I really took that on. I took that on in a way that I think didn't allow me to, at times, ask for help when normal, but in some other families, you might ask for help. "Hey dad, like college tuition, I need some help," or financial aid, or like that. I had to really like those. Asking for help in a financial way was really hard for me for quite a while, I would say. Not that I always get it anyway, but I think that was like, I think it's hard for anybody, let's be honest. But yeah.
But it's interesting you bring that up, and maybe it is the whole single mother aspect, but I too have a hard time asking for help and learned that from my own mother of taking care of yourself, making sure that you're on top of things, that you're busy, that you're taking care of your family, it's having all your ducks in a row, so to speak. Yeah. And as we grow up, though, of course, we try to figure out who we are, how we're separate from our parents. Was there something that you learned like, okay, mom, I know you do this, but I'm going to do that.
That is a lesson that I feel like I'm learning still today. I mean, obviously my mom and I have a very close relationship because it's just the three of us for quite a bit of our lives. My parents separated when I was 7. So I think the breakaway point for me, what you're describing is like individuating from my mother's experience and from my experience as I am a son of my mother, is no one in my family had gone to college. No one had gone to university. And so there was a point where my being at the top of my class, I wasn't number one. I was number 9, but being at the top, like being like the smart kid who was getting good grades, I was different than my mom and dad. And they made that clear to me in some way or another, that I was doing better at school than they had been. And that I would go to school, started at 7 a.m. I don't know what is happening. Why does school start so early? I was start at 7 a.m. and I would get home at 11 because of all the extracurricular stuff I'd be doing all day long. Right. And I remember my mom saying, "You better take a nap sometimes." Sometimes I think my mom is my voice for self-care because I would be like, I would be going and going and going and loving that I was going and going and going. And I'll just bring in another big piece of this picture is I went to a 3-year high school where there were 2,700 kids and there was one Black person, one Asian person, one Jewish person. We all knew who they were. So diversity was not a thing and gay was certainly not a thing. And so I think my busyness was part of me occupying my time so I didn't look at it. Because if I looked at it, I would be unsafe in this school. I'll also just share, and this is terrible, this high school has had 3 suicides since I left that school, all attributed to someone coming out as gay. So the school has done a lot of work on that since then. But I just think that it was not a safe environment for me to say I'm gay or for me to even accept that about myself. And so I think that combination of gay shame, trying to understand who I was, like falling in love, weird obsession love with my best friend. My best friend was a girl with her boyfriend, like all that. It was all layered in there of me separating from my mom because it was a noticing of I am different, not just because I'm your son, but I'm different. Like, oh, I'm different than what's around me. And so I think that had a lot to do with my separation from my mom. I don't think there was ever a time when we were distant from each other, but it was something that I was scared. What if she didn't accept me? What if she wasn't going to love her son anymore?
So did you have a feeling that these gay feelings were going to hold you back and keep you from being successful?
I think it was bigger than that. I think I thought that these gay feelings were going to, like I graduated from high school in 1994. So at this time, there was no Will and Grace. We're just coming out of people being all over the news for people are still dying of AIDS at this time, but we're just coming out of the really big, scariest time. And I thought that being gay was going to destroy my life, not just be successful, that I was not going to, I was going to be a persona non grata. I was going to not be a citizen anymore. I was going to not be seen in any way. And I'm certain that that's why being in the theater and being in speech and debate and those kinds of extracurriculars were, and getting good grades was a way that I was still being seen. Like I can't get seen. This part of me I have to hide or not look at yet, but I can be seen here. And so I can be seen for getting good grades. I certainly could have turned and been like, I'm going to be a class clown and be a bad kid and got seen that way. That's just not the way the cookie crumbled, right? Cookie crumbled that I had a mom who needed someone to be kind of dad-like to the little brother. So like I stepped into the being the good kid thing. And I'm so grateful that that was my experience. But I think that gay held me back from feeling like I could be a person for a while, and for a good while.
And that probably led you to be like, well, if I make money, if I'm secure in these other ways, then I can have some control. You know, I'm going to dismiss these feelings or this otherness I'm going through and be a part of society and productive in this other way.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. But I will just before I go say, I don't want to sign completely on that yet. I want to co-sign on half of that. The
okay,
other thing
okay,
that was, I want to say yes. And because I got that from my grades and I got myself, I really feel like I used high school to distract myself, distract yourself. Because what happened is third day of college, literally the third day of college, I called my mom and said, okay, I think I'm gay now. So like, I got into a different environment. Five of the 10 guys on my hallway were gay. I was in the fine arts dorm. It was like very safe space. So I really think my whole body was like, we just need to feel like we're safe enough to say this out loud. And I'd already told my mom, like at 16, like, I think something's going on. So I didn't know if it was going to hold me back from being successful. But I did, there was some degree of like, I'm gonna have to hide. So I think that even my saying, yes, I'm going to school for theater was an act of rebellion in some ways of like, I'm refusing to hide. I'm not going to stay in the closet, literally in the closet or in the closet, like the bigger closet. I'm going to pick something that's going to force me out. And I think I will say that I think going to Northwestern in some ways or getting good grades and going Northwestern and even being accepted, I did early decision for Northwestern. I think that even that alone kind of, in some ways I would say saved my life because there were some dark days in high school. There were some dark days in high school. And so knowing that there was going to be a place where I was probably going to be accepted helped. And then to show up there and then be accepted was, I was uncomfortable with it. I was like, wait, because everyone in the hallway just assumed that I was gay before. I was like, well, wait, I don't know if I need a minute here. Hold on. So 3 days later, I'm like, okay, fine, I'm gay. And then it took me a minute to catch up with my own, who I am, right? So it did hold me back in ways, but I think it was someone just waiting to unleash itself.
Well, that leads us perfectly into the third story you wanted to share. And this deals with what it means to look like or be a coach, because you had this idea that a coach is someone who is professional, professorial, you know, a teacher, which in your mind meant khakis and maybe a cardigan.
Yes,
you know,
totally.
You had it down to the costume. Of course, yes. You know, this is what us theater kids do.
Of course the costume. Yes, of course.
Of course, of course. Now, where did this idea of what a professional coach was, where did that come from?
When I went to life coach training, like proper training, went to multiple trainings to understand what it is to be a life coach. And I just remember being there and a majority of the people there are coming from a corporate background and they're wearing what they're wearing, business casual to work. And I was like, oh, I know what business casual is. I work for auditions all the time and I book those jobs, right? So I know what this wardrobe is. I know what this look is. I know who this person is. And there was some idea that coaching was like looking like therapy in some ways. Not that the coaching feels like therapy. I believe coaching can be therapeutic, but let's not confuse coaching and therapy. They're two different things. But like that you're like the neighbor of therapy. So we're wearing a lot of scarves and we're in a darker office and there's weird art on the wall and some weird pottery, right? Like that's a coach was. You get the image, right? Think of the therapist right on Big Little Lies. That's kind of what I thought the coach was, right? And I also thought there was some degree of like humor isn't needed. You can't have a sense of humor. You're meant to really talk in dark tones like this and really let someone feel present whenever they're there. And it's only about visualizations. And my training didn't actually teach me this. This is the story I like added to the training. I want to just share with you. Like some of it was this, but not all of it at all. It was very active.
This coach is another character. It's like, what is my meaning? What is my motivation? Yeah. Now I'm going to center myself into this. Yeah.
Yeah. And so what what started to happen, I think, was a little dangerous in a good way, is when I started this, tiny group coaching practice in New York City when I was there, and I would meet with people there. And at the time I did it, it was super selfish. I was like, I'm going to be helping myself stay accountable as an actor. And so I'm going to meet with these people every week, and I'm also going to kind of lead. And this actually tracks me back to my first story really quickly. I was like, I do not want to be a student of myself. I just want to be a coach for you guys. It was so much freer. I was so much freer doing that. So I guess that's a funny piece of the story I forgot. Like, that actually was a time when I started to notice, like, I don't like to coach myself. I just want to coach y'all. And that part of it, in that little tiny room, is where I started to notice, like, oh no, I can talk with my normal tone of voice. I can say things that are a little bit scandalous. And I started to understand this thing that I think is what I think makes creative people dangerously take up space in a good way, danger in a good way, which is we have to be willing to believe that everyone's not going to be our fan, and we don't need everyone to be our fan. And I think so many, what I needed to do is say, everyone is not meant to be my client. And the people that are will identify that I'm meant to be their coach because I am more me, not because I'm more milquetoast, not because I'm more bland, not because I'm more middle of the road. The more people will come to me is the more I am myself. And again, this tracks all the way back to being gay and hiding pieces. I think it's all a huge part of it. And I think that, you know, if you're trying to make the world your fan, your acting is probably pretty boring. If you're trying to make yourself the fan of your acting, then your acting is probably pretty awesome. And what I talk about this is, like, in the messaging that you might see somebody put out, right? The way that they send an email or their captions on their Instagram or whatever. This, if we're going to talk marketing for just a little bit for a second, because I think it helps to, it's a good analogy here, is the more you speak from what you truly believe in your real voice, the more likely you're going to have people who follow or unfollow. And, like, please unfollow and leave and don't be part of my world if you're meant to be with somebody else. Because if you're following me and I'm contributing to the noise of you not taking action, that is a waste. And I'm not doing what I want to do either. I would rather have you be saying full on yes to someone else because you are on board with what they're doing than be just, like, collecting the noise of everybody saying everything and not really moving forward with what it is that you're meant to do in this lifetime. And so I think that is where that understanding that I got, which weirdly came to me through marketing, I think, gave me freedom in be yourself. I've been thinking about, so we have a podcast episode that comes out today, and it's called How to Say Thank You Without Being Weird. And, like, that is the way I talk. Other people might not talk the way. I feel really proud of that title because it is exactly what I'm teaching. And if you don't get that, then great. Then this is not the right podcast for you or the right listen for you. But if it's something, if you're challenged by saying thank you and not feeling needy, then you know that this is the podcast episode to listen to, right? So it came through marketing, and then it gave me some dangerousness in truly being myself.
That's certainly one thing that I've learned through podcasting, just like yourself, is that niching down, finding that kernel of specific insight that can reach someone is actually going to reach and be more beneficial to people than trying to be generic and I'm all things to all people. That niching down, and this applies to us as people, as actors, finding that specificity of what we do and how we present ourselves is really what is going to bring the best connections our way.
Totally.
But that's hard. That is
it's
hard.
So, of course, it is, because listen, and I will just say this because I know that there's a black hole that a lot of actors go down around castability. If I can have a moment to talk about it, can I have a moment?
Have a moment.
Which is, you go down a black hole of, like, I can do everything. And I believe that you can. I do. Because I know how trained you are and how much experience you have. But I don't know you yet. I'm a stranger. Can you at least tell me what it tastes like if I'm going to order it on the menu? Like, I like to think of it as, like, if you go to the Cheesecake Factory, the menu is this tall and you flip through all things, you can't decide what you want. I don't go to the Cheesecake Factory often, mind you, but I'm just letting you know. But, like, or you go to a prefix menu where you're like, there are five things on the menu. It's just helping me know when I call in Catherine, I have a better idea what I'm going to get. It's because, like, she's helped me.
To go with this analogy, it's like when we go to a restaurant that we haven't been to before, and what's that first thing we ask the waiter? So what's your best dish? What do you recommend?
Yes.
We want to narrow this huge menu down to, yes, what are the one or two things that I need?
Yes. And so if we can think of it, instead of being like, I'm creating a creative prison for myself and I'll only act inside of this box or only work inside of this box, we're thinking of, let me give you an amuse-bouche of what I can offer. And then I can, because then what I do is I go, oh, this actor knows herself. That's what she can offer. I believe her because she's shown me she's not delusional. I can now buy into the idea that she can offer other dishes today. Right. So that, what I love is like, when you, this, let me use an email list, for example, So I have to send emails as part of my business. I have an online business, right? I am like, please unsubscribe, because I don't want to be in your inbox unless you want me to be there. And I want the people who get my emails to be the orange juice concentrate of people who are resonating with the work that I'm putting out there. And I always say, if you are not getting unsubscribes, if you're not going to an audition room and someone isn't, and this might not be the perfect analogy, but if you're not going to an audition room and someone is loving you and someone isn't like not so keen on you, you got to have both opinions in some way or another. You have to have someone who's saying, I love this, I don't love this. You've got to create a sharp enough shape that someone can say yes to you. I always think of this as like when you do cookie cutters and you put cookies in the oven and they come out like, this is a snowman and this is a horse. And then that comes out, looks like blobs. If you're a blob, we need to remember, we got to be able to see what you were, what you are. So you got to create a sharp shape so I can say yes or no to it.
Well, yeah. Brian, I have to remind you though, this is a social media age and I'm waiting on 150 people to like my latest post or I'm a failure. I only have 12 people like it, then why am I posting?
Oh, I know. Do you want me to really answer that question?
Yeah. I mean, because I know that I go through this myself, mostly as a podcaster, not so much in my personal social media, but as a podcaster, I'm trying to market, I'm trying to network, I'm trying to get more listeners. And so when 7 people like this post that I worked on for half an hour, I'm like, what the heck am I doing?
And of course, for source, I want to make sure we all can just speak knowledge. There is an algorithm going on that has nothing to do with you.
Oh my gosh.
There's like strategy that needs to go
us.
Right. There's strategy that has to help you. So I want to acknowledge that piece of it. And then the second part that I want to say is, you're called to being a podcaster. Oh, well, you got to factor. You got to fess up. You're called to be, you got to do it. No matter what, you got to do it. So you have to put that Instagram post up because that is you doing it. I think that the place where we can begin to ask a question, because I think it's the perfect question you ask, is you go, I keep on getting 7 likes. It keeps frustrating me. Frustration is a space of inspiration. You can be frustrated, inspired, or you can be like happiness inspired. It's like dark inspiration versus light inspiration. With light inspiration is like, I have an idea, I want to go do this. Darker inspiration is something isn't working, I need to go do this. So now the question for you to ask is, am I inspired enough to take action, spend money, or do something so that it gets better? Because it's not me. It's some lack of knowledge. I always relate back to, you know, as an actor, you're taught to be so freaking resourceful. Figure out the script, figure out the character. Backstory, bring all the stuff you need for the audition, bring all the stuff you need even when you get to on set, you might need to bring some of your clothes. Like you need to be so resourceful. And so that muscle that's grown is like so tightly wound that there are times when I think you're expect yourself to know things that you shouldn't know, you don't know how to do. And so it's when you have to like you said, raise your hand and ask for help. I need to hire somebody. I need to ask somebody. I need to know that I'm at my limit. And so I just want to offer that as some dish served cold solace to this idea of trying to get more likes on your Instagram post.
I don't. Yeah. And that goes back to what we were saying earlier about asking for help and how that can be so hard because, well, whether I'm an actor, whether I'm just a person in general, I can do this on my own. There's something wrong with me if I can't figure this out. I can do this. And then we just keep on grinding it out.
Yeah. And I also think that, you know, the shitty myth that is taught to us is we see someone else. It's like, oh, well, they're doing it on their own. And we think they're, and we just assume they have the exact same tools and resources and experiences that we do. So they've got all the exact same tools I do. So they're probably doing it. And we just forget, like, they have whatever kind of learning privilege, white privilege, whatever, pretty privilege. They have all the different things that they have training. They've got someone else doing it for them. And so we have to be really mindful of how quickly we're willing to hold up the mirror and say, this is about me and not about resources. What's in front of you? Tools.
Because we see other people. And so it provides in us an expectation or a standard that has to be met. And so whether we're, you know, actors or coaches like yourself, you know, with these preconceived notions, you know, we have these expectations of what an audition should be or how to perform on stage or how to work with other actors or directors. But are there actual rules that we need to be following and adhering to?
Yeah, I say no, just so you know. I tend to be the king of contrarianism. That tends to be, I really think that the reason why I say that is a lot of rules that have been established are often to keep you in your lane. Now, that isn't to say there aren't real social media strategies to help you get more likes and blah, blah, blah. I want to be very mindful of that. But I think a lot of times the rules are made up in our mind from a lack of exposure to either a willingness to put yourself out there or just a lack of exposure to training. Those two pieces. And most often it can be traced back to putting yourself out there. Like I find when I help, one of the things that every actor in the world, I think is like, not every actor in the world. Let me pause. Let me take a step back. A lot of actors might be like, I need to make a target list to find managers and agents. And I always go, oh yeah, why? How come? Because you really, you know those 12 people really well. You've like had, you know them. And like, no, I looked on Google or they're my friend's agent. Oh, so basically you don't know them at all. You've just kind of found them on the line. So you feel like, okay. So what you're doing is you're engineering small risk because you're afraid to put yourself out there. And because putting yourself out there to managers and agents is such a vulnerable experience, you're trying to control some piece of it by making a tiny list. So at least only 12 people are saying no to you. And I have a strong belief that that is a bunch of BS. But the truth is, you can stay there, but what would it be like to reach out to three times that many people, or five times that many people, or six times, 20 times that many people, where you really put yourself out there and allow yourself to be seen? And part of what comes for me is with the spiritual background is when you make a target list, you're literally tying the universe's hands and saying, I know the 12 people that should be my manager agent because I know exactly what should happen next, as opposed to saying, I don't know who's going to want to work with this incredible talent over here, but I'm going to show up in a way where all the stars in the sky can choose, think if they want to work with me and let them know who I am. And that is way more vulnerable. That's how I help actors find agents, clearly. But the reason I'm sharing that is only because I think that's a rule that we grab onto because other actors are doing it, other people around us are doing it, instead of taking a pause and saying, what is the truth around this? And that's not to say that target lists can't work, but I still think when you're using a target list, there could have been 20 other agents who would love to meet with you.
Is it that shift of expectation or how we present ourselves that we're trying to be what the agent or manager wants rather than figuring out if the agent is who we need?
Yeah, it is, and it's so beautiful the way you said that because it goes back to what we said earlier. It's some version of, I want to make sure that I'm only hitting up the people who actually want this, which I'm serving over here, what I have going on. And you have no business because you don't know that person or their roster or the way they think about their roster. And so what you're doing is you're making all kinds of assumptions based on very little data to decide that that you're going to be right for them. And it's such mishigas bullshit, like not fair to you or them. Because actually what I would want you to do is be so much yourself in the way that you are reaching out there, that the people who don't want you will give you a really clear no. Because you know, I know how unsatisfying it is when you reach out and you don't even hear anything. Like, let's get some good no's. Get some good no's so we can quit wasting our time on them. And then we get to lean towards the yeses. I remember I was talking to an actress the other day and she was very challenged by, she's having her second child. She's pregnant right now. She's very much like, I just don't know if I should reach out right now. I don't know if the agent's going to want me. And da 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 da. And I said, well, how about we be really honest with what's going on with you right now? And the agent who's excited about what's going on with you right now will reveal themselves because you're going to be so clear. Now, this isn't to say that we're writing these emails that are like nothing about who you are as an actor. I want to be really mindful. Like everybody go like, I'm pregnant. Do you want to represent me? It's not the email I'm telling people to send. So I just want to be clear. But I'm wanting you also to say is like, by being authentic, you get the people who are not your persons to reveal themselves. We need them to self-select them out of your list. We need them to have the privilege and the dignity of saying, oh yeah, I'm not your person. And that is what I think is the if I'm able to say like, that is what I believe is the truth of putting yourself out there, is by giving people the dignity of self-selecting that you're not their person. And to do that, you have to put some skin in the game. You have to show up, you have to be seen. And I think that's been the journey of my life, if I can say. You know, like being in high school and having the people who are like, Brian's gay, don't talk to him. I mean, that's not exactly how it happened. It was more like jerky football players being assholes, but that's kind of right. I can tell you all their names if we want to go cancel them. but like that was what it was more, but that's the journey of what, like, cool. That's why I leaned into the theater classes where people did say, yes, Brian, we want you. And, you know, I had every girlfriend in school say like, I want to be your friend. Right. So like the lean into the places where you're wanted.
Well, I certainly appreciate you showing up here today and offering your insights and your experiences. It's been such a joy to talk to you and relate to you. I feel like we've connected because we've presented our unique selves with each other. So I feel like we've made a connection today. So I appreciate that.
This has been one of the most, I will say, probing and personal interviews I've ever had. And I feel very naked and I'm really delighted that this happened today. And I feel so seen today. So thank you for the opportunity to answer these questions.
Here's the bathroom.
I'll take some khakis and a sweater. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining Brian Pataka and myself today. But remember, the conversation continues not only with that audition story bonus episode, but also with the final five questions on the WinMe blog. You'll find a link to all that in the show notes, as well as his own podcast called Brian Breaks Character. Now, it takes you behind the scenes with people who proudly walk that path least taken, offering some down and dirty advice for those of us in the creative field. Now, as I mentioned earlier, it was Brian's team that actually reached out to me to come on this podcast. And when I first chatted with him on Instagram, he had this to say: "I'd love to be on your show. I've been listening, and I love your honesty and kindness on the show. Have a great day, and I'm looking forward to it." Well, I really appreciate the honesty and kindness you've shown here as well. You've given me a lot to think about in how I approach myself as an artist and as an individual. Well, that does it for me, Patrick Oliver Jones, in charge of writing, editing, and producing this podcast. Why I'll Never Make It is a WinMe Media production and is a part of the Helium Radio Network and a member of the Broadway Makers Alliance. Join me next time as we talk more about Why I'll Never Make It.